So this period of time is a period for inquiry. Just take again a couple of minutes to give the general outline of the time. There may be questions, of course, which have arisen for you during the days here, coming possibly from the meditations, from the small groups, one-to-ones, instructions and talks. And sometimes there are areas of issue and concern, both in the personal world, but also equally important in the impersonal world, which matter for you. And you're very much invited to come and take a seat here, and then the inquiry gets underway. It's a contribution towards some investigation, looking into things, and two people exploring, and possibly out of that, some insight or understanding or inspiration or fresh ideas may emerge. It is not with the inquiry the intention to find quickly and easily some immediacy of resolution. Resolutions are not in the hands either of the speaker, or the inquirer, or myself, or others. Resolutions to things come in other ways, quite often unexpected, and ways which can't easily be explained with the rational mind. So the exploration takes place, shifts in the inner life can take place, and possibly out of that movement and that inner activity, some insight or resolution may come, sometimes in the moment, sometimes in the middle of the night, and sometimes a decade or two later. Frankly, the sooner the better, but nevertheless, it's not in our hands. If one had an immediate resolution for something, then of course one would state it. Or might hold it back. Where the inquiry is taking place, please remember as well the significance of listening. Please remember that all human problems, all human conflict, amongst the many factors which contribute to it, certainly a major, major one is that which we say and that which we listen to. And it's a challenge for all of us really to be able to listen outwardly, the voices, and inwardly, the inner voice. What's the response, if any, in the process and activity of the listening? And that response with regard to the inner voice, just to take notice of, however, whatever form it may express itself. With inquiry time as well, the person or myself can say thank you to bring it to a close, and then there'll be, after a couple of shared silent minutes together, another invitation, another one may come. So in fact we're moving between the silence into the inquiry back into the silence. In the old days of the teachings, time of the Buddha, he didn't have disciples, he gave up this rather, that's 2,600 years ago, this old-fashioned model of gurus and disciples, dispensed with all of that, and those who came were known as the Shravanas, the ones who listen. It was very much a listening tradition, a listening practice, and bringing in silence and meditation and listening, and thus the time-honored statement there, ehi pasiko o panayiko pachatam veditabo vinyuti. You must see through your own experience. That's been the criteria. You must see through your own experience. And so in our listening, as I mentioned a couple of nights ago, the experience of one person may be our experience. And certainly from the earlier inquiry, it did touch quite a few places and responses from a number of you in terms of what was said. You could relate to that in your own relationships, whether with family or with friends or with yourself. So really worthwhile for all of us to give attention to persons, in fact, who are speaking. And sometimes it does touch places that we need to address. We can look at, we can get some insight into. And that's part of that intimacy of the Sangha, of the practice. So anyone who would like to come, who didn't come to the previous one, then you're welcome to come. There's already someone wishes to come. And as per usual, if you're okay with the recording,
I'm okay.
You're okay, and therefore anyone on planet Earth is welcome to listen. The gods and the devils and the humans and the angels. Yes, please.
Alaya. They told us a story today about a child that was only needed to be accepted.
Yes.
I feel that my question comes from this need to be accepted.
Yes.
So I'm asking you to accept me.
You're accepted.
The problem is that it's a technical question that often rises even aggression from teachers in Tavana. So
I missed that. I missed the sentence.
So that's not the first time I'm asking this question, and I often found teachers not to be so tolerant about this question, ignored it, or had an aggressive response to it. So I'm careful. But until I get my answer, or be accepted, or both, I will not rest.
Well, we're all curious about the teachers that you just to, so that we can prepare ourselves. So you feel free, it's the Sangha. Everything can be named. If you wish. If you don't wish to name, it's also fine.
Are you serious?
Completely. I'm serious. This is a Sangha. Sangha means the gathering of men and women of inquiry and exploration. And if we can name indirectly our mothers and our fathers and our brothers and our sisters and our children in issues, if we wish, no pressure, if we wish, we can also name our teachers.
I will not speak of teachers that are not here.
All right, fine.
Only of one who is here.
All right,
here.
Okay.
I asked him the question.
Yes. Well, that cuts it down by two. Go on.
First, he didn't understand it. Then he answered something else.
Right.
And then he added that I need to be, or I would better be less dogmatic.
Less dogmatic?
Yes. Mm. And I found it aggressive because either, like, if you're honest with yourself, just answer me. Don't teach me how to live my life or how to be. The Buddhist way is the middle way, but sometimes the middle way is so far from mainstream that but what can we do? Like, we are looking for our soul. That's our role. That's our, like, right.
you telling me to be very careful what I say?
Be gentle.
okay. So the original one was, please accept me, I assume.
No,
it wasn't. Oh,
it wasn't.
All right. What's the original?
No, the reason I'm asking this question is because I want to be accepted. But of course, I attack the weakest link of Tovana. That's what I feel. That's why I gave all this discourse before asking it. Now I'm going to ask it, if it's
so
okay.
Ask it. Curious about the question. Yes, please ask.
Yes, okay. So my question is...
Thank you.
Here in Tovana, and I think Buddhists in general, but I don't care about Buddhists, only about Tovana. Here in Tovana, people don't treat animals as equal to people, because we milk cows, but cows don't milk us. When milking a cow, you treat it as inferior. In the kitchen, people serve cheese and butter. And that's okay if you feel that animals are inferior to food people. I just want to know if this is ideological or why is it so?
I'm not the voice of Tovana, but I can respond as one person here. Okay. It's an important area for all of us to reflect upon. Can I assume that with the question around diet and butter and cheese and milk and things, am I assuming you're a vegan? Is that right? A vegan.
Well, actually, ideologically, I'm against using milk, eggs, and honey. But I also don't eat meat because it hurts my heart, but it's not ideological. So sometimes if I really need meat, I eat it, but I never touch a cheese or eggs or honey.
Right. So, in the view with regard to the diet that Tovana provides, which my experience is a healthy, nutritious diet, which to quite some degree gives support to animal, bird, and fish welfare by not directly eating animal, birds, and fish.
No, and I see it as the opposite. Like, when you milk a cow, you exploit it. But if you kill it, you treat it as equal. Like in war, for example, the Germans killed Russians.
Slowly.
They felt equal.
Getting a little... Well. You've got enough to do with cows and milk, let alone world wars. In the consideration to animal welfare that sometimes people do come on retreats, appreciate the diet which is offered, and for some people that genuinely brings about a change. Some people, and including myself, do not under any circumstances eat animal, birds or fish, under any circumstances. It's a small, for myself, an important contribution to the welfare of animals. and very frankly, very little in the way of dairy product there. But it's something for all of us, I would say, to reflect on there. Are you asking that the milk dairy products should be out of the retreats? That there should be, as there is no birds, animals, fish in the diet directly, are you suggesting and proposing no milk, dairy, cheese products, eggs, honey, etc.?
Well, actually, since it seems more logical to me to eat fish and chicken and beef than to eat dairy, cheese and butter, then I would say that there is a table which is called miyuchadim for special people, special needs, like people that have gluten problems. I would say that on this table, they should put meat, steaks, chicken, and also of course dairy, cheese,
Let me slowly.
But say that it's not mainstream, because mainstream is not harming animals and treating them as equal. You cannot speak of AIDS as Iran spoke. You're not allowed, like, you should respect ants, Nemanim. You should respect ants. And then you know that people here in the kibbutz are milking cows and are proud of it. I'm sorry.
What I would suggest is that since there is a concern, you write a proposal to Tovana. The teachers and the guiding committee will read it and take decisions upon it. What I can say is that in the abattoirs where animals and birds are killed, that these places are terrible places of terror, fear and violence upon the animals through their execution. And I can say as well that if you look on YouTube, if you read the reports, if you go to my last Dharma E-News, where there is a significant debate and dialogue taking place, where friends have set up organizations for retreats to look into the area of diet, you will see that there is a really strong concern about it. But it does need people to write and put forward suggestions. And I just suggest that you do that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Quiet minute together, and then another voice. Yes, anyone, anytime. Yes, please, come. Yes.
Okay. My question is, it's hard here.
Take your time.
Okay. My question is about me being open, or actually not open.
Open or not open?
Not open.
Yes.
With my mom.
With your mother?
Yes. Mm-hmm. As a person, I'm very open with everybody around me, except my mom. The question is, the issue that I'm trying to figure out how, what can I do in order to work on is, basically, I will give a background a little bit. I'm not open with her since I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
Then around age of 18, I guess, I started to be more open with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
With her, I still stayed like that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it bothered me today because it's shame. I'm not blaming her anymore because I used to say that's the way she raised me and that's already constant questions. I still think it's her fault, but I'm not blaming her anymore. It's kind of a joke, but it's just the way it is. So I'm looking for a way to work in order to change this situation, because when I can't just start to talk with her because I'm having pains in my stomach when I'm trying to talk about anything that is personal. So I'm trying to figure out how can I be more open. But before that, what can I do in order not to be in such panic or physical pains? Even if I try to breathe into it, it doesn't work.
I bet this is the voice that the psychotherapists in the room hear a lot. This issue. I'll just quote the Buddha for a moment. I'm not a big fan of this openness, by the way. So I just get that in quickly.
Okay, thank you.
All right. It all belongs to the contemporary spiritual ideology. It's not my cup of tea at all. But more importantly than that, in the history of it, just take the Buddha for a moment here. He was asked, as with the inquiry now and previously as well, about this relationship that we have with the parents. And the parents, as I mentioned, being the first two gods in our life, the first two major authority figures, either by presence or by absence. And when asked, and sometimes he said, people would look at their history and say, my parents were very angry and negative and blaming. Another person may say, my parents never gave me any attention. They were never around for me. They were always working or having their social life. Another person, Buddha said, may say, my parents were very tight. They never gave me anything. They never gave me support. They only thought about what they wanted, and they didn't really care and give me the kind of support that I needed. And there are these three kinds of parents. And then he was asked, well, what do we do when we have one of these kind of parents there? And he said, if the parent has been blaming and fault-finding and putting one down, then one's practice is to develop loving kindness and as the antidote to the poison of being blamed. One develops loving kindness. If one parent has not been present for one, they've always been socializing, they found one inconvenient or whatever, then one develops the practice of really being present for other people, really giving other people, as a practice, the care and attention that one didn't receive oneself. If one's parents have been very tight, haven't been generous, haven't been able to give there, then one develops the practice of generosity and the practice of giving. And if that's taken seriously and that is really developed as a practice, then the criteria with your good mother will be to speak that which is both true and useful for both of you. It's to be true and it's to be useful. If it's true and not useful, if it seems useful but it's not true, and so sometimes the relationship, in this case, with a parent, because of history, does, as you point out, and other adults in the room will know exactly the same, make it difficult for the kind of open communication there. One has to be reasonable and clear with these things. There are some things which are helpful to talk with parents about, and there are some things which is simply not helpful. It's not helpful for the parent, and it's not helpful for oneself. You've got to be very clear there. Just getting off something off one's chest about the past may be a relief for one, but it may bring terrible pain and confusion for the other.
What I mean is not that I want to talk with her about the past.
No.
There's no point.
No.
I'm fine with the past. Just when things happening to me right now in my life,
yes,
I don't share. And it's not like I ate whatever today. It's like big things in my life that I can't share.
Mm.
I can't be open with her. And sometimes I'm thinking, oh, but she will hear about it from another person, or that's not right. And everybody knows but her. And that's a problem. It's important information, I guess.
So always with these areas, the issue of intention is important. It's the critical ear. So in other words, if you are going to take any steps and take some risk, you will have to check and have to feel, does your mother have the intention and interest and curiosity to know and listen to what's happening in your life?
Definitely, yes.
Definitely, yes.
She would be very happy. Just
right.
The thing is that I don't know how to deal with my tension, what to do, how to work on it in order to get over it.
That's the starting point of the talk. That's where you start. Mum? Do you want to call her mum? Well, I say mum in my mother. Ima. Ima. Nice. Better than Ima. I. Anyway, so sometimes with Ima, if you came across very positively, she is interested, she wants to know what's happening for her daughter in her life, and what's happening for her daughter in her life at the present time, she's feeling, she'll want to hear that. So that's the place where you start talking. In a time where there's some time and space for you to be together, uninterrupted, no pressure, at ease with each other, then you say, Mum, Ima, it's da da da. That's what you don't imagine you can prepare this. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, a couple of quiet minutes and then another invitation. Yes, anyone, anytime. Yes. Anyone? Come, if you wish. One person here, then afterwards I'll...
I have stage fear, so...
Yes, stage fright.
Never spoken in
a
microphone.
You've never spoken in a microphone?
No. My first time on stage.
So. On stage.
I guess I'm done.
Performance is over. All right, go on.
My name is Saya. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the wanting mind.
Yes, you did, yes.
I can't remember, it was a long time ago. But I remember that I thought about fantasizing.
Yes.
And I know that in my life, I fantasize a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually helps me to move or set goals for my future.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if there's any good in fantasizing.
Tell me a couple of the fantasies of the last 2 hours. And I'll tell you if there's any good in them.
I was fantasizing to work with little kids for years.
For you?
And now I am a preschool teacher.
You're what?
I'm a preschool teacher.
All right.
It took me a long time, but I was literally fantasizing, and I was asking myself where I want to see myself.
Hmm. Yes. So, if I get it right, to some degree, the fantasy is already actual. You're already a preschool teacher. And the fantasy is in its continuity over years. Is that the?
Yeah, I mean, I don't fantasize about it anymore.
Yeah.
But I fantasize about my future.
About your future?
In other areas.
Right. Mm. And what hope, if any, that the fantasy will have some relationship to reality? Is there any hope? Possibility?
Yeah.
Tell us one. If you wish.
I remember that once in a yoga class, the teacher
said,
close your eyes and imagine where where would you want to be if you were in your full potential?
Oh, interesting. What did you, what was your, oh, I'm curious. All right.
I was traveling with no worries and sleeping outside. I was far away and alone in the dark.
All right. This is a happy fantasy or a nightmare?
Full potential.
Full potential. All right. How long ago did the fantasy in the yoga class take place?
3 years.
And how much time have you spent alone in the dark? Outside.
Fulfilled. I'm getting there.
You're getting there.
I don't sleep outside, but I sleep
what about
here in the retreat. That's a lot.
What about tonight? Outside, in the dark. So you can feel fulfilled.
I'm not ready yet.
Why not?
Just not right there.
How are you going to get there?
It takes, everything in my life takes years.
Years?
Years. So maybe my 30th retreat, I'll sleep in a tent.
This is a fantasy. That's not sleeping outside, that's sleeping in a tent.
Yeah, that wasn't my fantasy. It's,
oh, all right.
Here is very safe. Yeah, I would do that. Maybe the next retreat, I'm not sure. But my fantasy was no fear.
No fear?
Yeah.
Could there possibly be a safer place to sleep outside alone than Eindhoven tonight? Could there be any safer place than all this kindness and warmth and support for you?
No, I agree.
It couldn't be better than this, could it?
Couldn't. I'm not afraid. I have no fear here.
That's no, true. Exactly. All right. So?
No, so the question, I'm going back to the question.
But you asked me a question. I'm trying to give some encouragement.
Okay, no, I was thinking maybe I wasn't enough clear about my question, but I trust you. You got the question. So.
Fantasy, in the language here is a different. Fantasy here is the unfortunate use of the mind, which has some element of avoidance in it, there, and it's just a fantasy which never gets down to earth. I think what you're speaking of in our language would be, and it's useful and appropriate, of creative imagination with a particular direction to a particular goal, which you sense is, in this case, beneficial for you or beneficial for others. Beneficial for you, having the courage to sleep outside at night. Beneficial for others in your role as the teacher. If it doesn't get actualized into the world, into the real, shall we say, if it doesn't get actualized, it's a fantasy. It's useless, purposeless, an utter waste of a good mind, and because it's not going anywhere. And when I was asking you, I got this sense of fantasy, not creative imagination. Oh, maybe after 30 retreats. whole world could have finished by then, there. And you wouldn't want to get to the latter period of your life, and then you're in a wheelie, and you haven't got a wheelie. You know the Zimmers, those old, you know.
What is that?
And you haven't got the energy left to get outdoors, to get to the garden. So is it going to be a fantasy or a creative imagination which actually takes root? Then it's something creative and adventurous. Which is it going to be?
No, I understand.
Good.
So maybe it's good to set, like for myself, time for creative thought or setting the goal.
All right then.
Like 5 minutes.
All right, so we might create some time. It's valuable to let this wonderful power we have as human beings to be creative, to use our imagination. You know, the arts can be a wonderful expression, and many artistic people here in the room who use creative imagination and then actualize there. Sometimes it can be useful to set a time limit there, so there isn't the constant postponement. What would be a useful time limit for your sleeping outdoors? You say, and then if it happens within the time, say it was creative imagination. If it's just more postponement, 30 lifetimes, was it? No, 30 retreats. Then it's just a fantasy. Would you like to set a time?
No, I think it's only a fantasy. At the moment.
Only a fantasy?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Fair enough. No, we just want to be connected with ourselves.
Yeah.
Can I speak a couple of minutes on the virtues of sleeping outdoors? to be a little bit supportive. When I was a monk, some years ago now, apart from the monsoon, I slept outdoors three or four years. With the mosquito net, as we had, 9 months in the cave, there, up in the hills, and absolutely wonderful, wonderful for their intimacy and closeness with the stars above and the earth below, and to witness the sun come up and the sun go down there, and the precious stillness of the night. It's a beautiful, precious time, and sometimes, as you say, your yoga class, and one listens within, and then there's some response. Actually, it's a deep and it's a beautiful response that comes out. And I appreciate, of course, for some people, and of course for women, perhaps often more than men, there's certain vulnerabilities. I really appreciate that, of course. But sometimes we are in environments where we feel loved and we feel supported and we feel safe there, and that makes for more possibility. And sometimes one can be safe, like as a monk, of course, tremendous safety, but in the cave around, of course, one's also in the company of snakes and cobras and scorpions and spiders and all sorts of things of the night, and one learns to watch one's sensations, you know, if you say. So it may just come alive again at some point. And we want to listen to the deep. And I think it's a good question from the yoga teacher. We want to listen, and if it's something valuable and adventurous and creative, to see if we can follow it through.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Couple of quiet minutes to go, please. Yes, there's the gentleman at the back. Please come. Okay with, I forgot to ask, but okay with the recordings, everybody, so far?
Okay.
Yes, yes, sir.
I try English, but
yes.
If not, I change to Hebrew.
Yeah, please feel free, and,
and
I will translate.
It's not the first time that in the meditation, I feel that when I'm coming to meet with especially pain,
yes,
whatever I'm trying to do,
mm-hmm.
It's become worse.
Worse.
It's become, yes, stronger.
Yeah.
And I have a four-year-old daughter.
A four-year-old daughter.
Old daughter, yes. Mm. And today, suddenly, I remember that my daughter, sometime when she hurt,
yes,
she start to cry,
mm.
and then nothing helps. If I try to, you know, to hug her or to say, come to daddy, nothing. And she said, I want to, come alone.
Mm.
And it's it's the same.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes. Say a little bit. Which way is it the same? What's the similarity?
My daughter is like my pain.
Uh huh. when the pain arises, mostly sitting posture. Or other postures?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
No.
Any particular area in the body where
yes.
the pain, which?
In the
shoulders?
Neck,
back of the neck.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sometime in the area of the heart.
Heart area.
From this side and also
and
the other side.
Yes. There. And can it be at any time during the day? Or is it persistent, or just sometimes? What's the sense?
I think it's usually not in the beginning of the meditation.
Mm.
After half an hour, or
yeah.
maybe
Yes, it's a period of time.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. With the two locations, are they regularly just in those two places? Is it pretty well always heart and the top of the back of the leg?
No. It can be anything, another
yeah.
place. Yes.
All right, okay. When the pain is there and arising there, what's the general attitude or relationship to the physical pain? Is it being with, acceptance, looking into, resisting?
No, yes, in my thoughts.
Your thought, yeah.
I think I accept it.
Yes.
But I think it's only in my thoughts.
Mm. Right.
Yes, and today I think maybe I even, angry.
Yes.
Of it, yes.
Yeah, all right. As you point out, thoughts can be very deceptive. They can give the appearance, but it's the deeper that's always more important. And with pain, especially the physical pain, it's a pressure. Pain is a contraction. This blood energy is not flowing easily and freely. This is there. That pressure, if there's not enough relaxation in our being, the pressure will
begin to hit on the feeling emotional life, exactly as you said, then one starts to resist and then get angry or upset, and often following on from that will come the doubts. So it's often it's a movement, pain, working with pressure, some reaction starting, and
out of meditation
and all the doubts. Mm-hmm. And that is a very common cycle. But it's a very common cycle that goes on in other situations. Pain, struggle, reaction, doubt. It's the typical dependently arising sequence. In that sequence, anything helps you?
Yes. If I caught it, you know, in the right moment,
yeah.
I just, you know, leave it alone.
Yeah.
And it's help.
All right. Nice. Okay. So, when does it seem to be the right moment? So you can...
Good question.
Give me a good answer. Is it... go on.
I think if I'm not too stressed.
Right. All right. Okay. With the dynamic, lovely to hear your voice because it's important for all of us here. With the dynamic that takes place, as you said at the very, very beginning, we look at pain, we're aware of it, and in looking at it, it appears like the pain is getting stronger. It can be true, of course. But it can be that the awareness or the mindfulness is getting closer. Mm-hmm. And in getting closer, it's not that it's getting stronger, it's just standing out more clearly. And if I've got my hand here and I got it here, see the lines of the hand. So the other, of course, is that there is pain in the body. The stress element either can be some carrying from the past, other pain, stress situations, which then, so to speak, lands in the present, and it's fuel, it feeds the pain. So the combination of resistance, struggle, willpower, trying to control, and the stress of that will also intensify the pain. And when there is the fighting with it, it will bring the doubt. It has to. I can't do this. I'm not ready for this. What am I doing here? Etc., etc. And again, it's the tracking of the sequence. Pain, the relationship to the pain, the learning to relax into it, as you said, catching it, that moment, seeing if we can catch it without the stress. And following and trying to remember that the doubt is a reaction born from pain. Some people identify with the doubt. You never see them near the meditation of Krishna for the rest of their life. They had pain.
But you know, it's like an echo. It's like
it is.
Echo. The thoughts become, you know, stronger, and then the pain becomes stronger.
Exactly.
And then the struggle starts,
yes.
And
yeah,
nothing to do.
Yeah. And it's true. We shouldn't forget the incredible influence of the mind upon the body. Mm. And sometimes two examples which would immediately come to mind, I can see with myself and hear from others as well, that there's the meditation, there's pain in the body, there is waiting for the old gong to go there, and it seems like the pain level is increasing there, and one can't endure one more minute one there. And then the gong goes, and suddenly all this pain suddenly starts dissolving. And one sits there, continuous, like a Buddha.
No pain.
No pain. Everybody else has gone after walking there. So if the pain was purely in the body, the gong ain't going to make any difference. It will say, because it's a bodily event. So sometimes it's body, sometimes it's mind, stress, pressure, willpower, fighting, resistance, anger, like you said there. And sometimes it's a combination of the two. And the more extreme, I had once in the United States, lovely, actually a Jesuit priest, young guy, about 27, in a railway accident, he had lost both his legs from above the knees. He would come into the hall there and then lower himself down onto the cushion and sit. And he had this phenomena of what they called the ghost pain, the phantom pain. Yeah. And he would sit and he would be experiencing pain in the ankles, pain in the knees, and he lost above the knee there. And wondering how long he could go on sitting because of this pain he was experiencing in his legs. And he said to me, he had to open his eyes to check that there were no legs there. But the memory, and he was 15 when he lost the legs, he was 27 years of age, had retained itself so strongly, and he never done meditation before, but sitting there, and people talking about pain and he experiencing it, and it can't be. Mind is a powerful instrument, the phantom pain. And sometimes with us, it's, yes, there is pain there, or here, but the mind's reaction to it. And as the Buddha commented on this, one pain is enough in life. In the body, why double it?
So, what do you suggest to do after all this talking?
Eh? Follow the sequence. So, in other words, one, as we discussed, come to sit, and it may be 5, 10, 20 minutes, as you point out. You may need and have the freedom to change the posture. You know, when we don't want a whole hall full of control freaks, as in some other traditions, I might add. Yes. And
with no names.
Eh? Well, no. No. Only other people do that. So when the time comes when we have to change the posture, can the change be conscious? That's the key. Can the change in the movement, say, of the legs, or if you move the back, or you lift the shoulders up, or whatever it might be, in the actual movement that takes place there, can that be done mindfully and consciously? So one relieves the pain, one enters into a new position, stays with that, calm with that, clear, relaxed with that, pain is gone, feel settled. And then, at some point, returning back to the original position. So there is a feeling and a sense that despite movement of the body, there, because one doesn't want to be exerting all this control and willpower, it's not healthy for us, but there's still a sense of continuity there. And as you said earlier, not identifying the thoughts as the voice of authority. The thoughts may reflect calm and well-being and may be accurate, but sometimes they're terrors and not being. Okay, thank you. You.
So we'll have a quiet minute, and then I'll just give a little reflection. With the first inquiry, I touched upon a little bit with the outer to the inner. In the teachings here, we are concerned with from the outer to the inner, in this case, what we eat and drink, and finding a balance and clarity with that. And sometimes, not always easy, to reflect, and to see whether it's wise and appropriate and skillful for us to make changes sometimes in the diet, to have some vigilance about that, and to guard against one becoming very obsessive about food things, which is one vulnerability, and the other is just being ruled by habit and conditioning, which is the other. And as always, and as was mentioned, the sense of some exploration and inquiry, and to see what is appropriate. For some of us, I think it's unfortunate, in this, for example, in the UK, 10 million animals and birds are eaten every week. It is a huge industry. We have been given told a lot of propaganda that we need protein. And people have identified with this, and very easily, oh, I need my protein is one of the rationalizations. There are many sources for protein, but not to underestimate the potency of the propaganda from the meat industry with regard to this. And some in care and love for animals, to remember as well with animals, they are like babies or young children who don't have language. They feel, they know comfort and pleasure, they know pain, they know contentment, they know fear, they know anxiety. And if we can just find ways in our life to give care to the animal realm and give support. And for some, not just for health reasons, but out of care and concern and compassion, that sometimes brings about some change in our diet. Religion, including Buddhism, is not very wise nor healthy nor understanding about this, I have to say. And our brothers and sisters in the yoga tradition much more conscious with regard to diet. And many of my good friends who we have yoga teachers there, much more concerned with diet as part of their practice. And I think we need that as well. And thank you to the person who there, and any responses and comments, please do contact networks and organizations there to encourage, both within our schools, for our children, and in our personal lives, and within organizations and with retreat centers, to really give consideration to a skillful and wise diet.
in the looking again at in areas of touching upon these areas of relationship and relationship to influential figures in our life, my hesitation about openness is that it easily becomes an ideal, and in the ideal one can be easily can generate views and opinions either about ourselves or about others. And so sometimes, oh, I should be more open there. Why can't I be more open? And this can end up with a lot of blame, judgment, criticism of ourselves, because we have this ideal, because we've heard it in such places as here. And then sometimes the view then goes to other people, even our loved ones. Oh, you're not being open with me. And then the blame and the judgment then falls on others there. And if there is the strong voice and the heavy voice with people, it's very difficult under pressure to be open. If you want somebody not to respond to what you say, just say to them, you're not being open with me. This will guarantee they won't be. Because the pressure is too uncomfortable. The potential to share comes from trust. It comes from love. And that makes it possible. And lovely to hear in terms of the communication, in this case with the mother, if there's a recognition that the other is interested and is curious and wants to know, and you check there. It's the important principle is being skillful and true. What is useful and true. And if I may say, and I'm sure many of us, those of us have been on the road and have, you know, in the old days, writing letters to one's parents and having diaries, talking personally now. Everything that went in those letters, I can tell you, was completely censored by me. So I write to them. So they didn't hear about the marijuana, the hashish, the LSD and the lifestyle and the opium and the uppers and the downers and all those things that one tended to do, hitchhiking between here and India, etc. I'm having a lovely time, Mummy. The people are so kind. It's sunny outside. More than enough. So sometimes wisdom is not being open. Wisdom is speaking or saying what is true and useful. And true and useful is the criteria for us here. And sometimes there are people who are close to and we can share with them. And it's very precious to have that opportunity and that communication there. In the attention and with regard to listening and working with issues like the painful issues and other areas of life as well. The old texts give the lovely reminder. What takes place here, this body, also reveals what takes place out there. So it may seem that our meditation, our practice, as the Buddha said, the whole world to some degree is here. So what I mean by that is how, as we were just listening to the good gentleman there, lovely to hear the voice, such an important one, that in the relationship to pain, in this case pain in the back, shoulders, the heart, or whatever, how we relate to it shows the kind of responses that happen inwardly. When there is pain around what's happening around us, the same kind of responses will come. They have to, because the same mind. So when we're finding it difficult to give attention to something, breathing, as you said, it may well and will actually indicate and reflect for us other areas which require our attention and we're finding it difficult to give attention to. What our relationship to what goes on between head and toes, breathing and body, is a mirror image of what goes on in our relationship to what goes on out there. It can't be any different because it's the same mind in the same relationship. That's why we practice. That's why we go through the struggle. That's why we work on ourselves, because if the inner life changes and sense of well-being and harmony comes in relationship to breathing and body and the pain that comes, it gives us the resources and the attitude and the change to be able to work with others, to be able to give others total, concentrated attention, which every human being needs and deserves, because when somebody really listens to us and that really connects with us, we feel accepted. We feel loved. And when you and I really give full attention to another human being or to a group of human beings, full attention, and we concentrate on their need, that is called love. And when we feel that love, that contributes a lot to feeling understood and feeling accepted. That's why we practice. Thank you.